Hello, this is Chris O'Regan, and you're listening to The Sausage Factory. Episode of The Sausage Factory. In this show, we interview video game developers and ask them how they made to start making games, what their influences are, and who inspires them. Split into two halves, the show initially focuses on the developer themselves, and in the second half, we discuss the game they're here to promote, which in this case is Distance by Refract Studios. Jordan.
Hi there.
Who are you, and what do you do?
I'm Jordan Hemway. I'm the creative director at Refract Studios. Mostly I'm the guy who's just bouncing around from every random category, from art to code to design to producing in business. And I do almost all of the music in the game, all the sound design, stuff like that. So I stay busy.
So that's your fault then, that I've got tunes in my head that I can't.
Yes, absolutely. Any sound in the game you don't like, definitely blame me.
It's not like
or
it.
Love.
It's just, yeah, that's it. It's just like,
I'll take
yeah.
this too.
Yeah, take that. It's definitely a thumper guy sort of thing going on.
Oh yeah.
That's a game.
but,
but there's something else much more to it. There's a lot more going on with Distance, everyone. And I first encountered it. It was your first PAX East. Definitely. People kept on dragging me to your booth going, play this game.
Yeah. And, all right.
It was great. And it was huge reception. Loads of people loved that booth. You had a good spot back then.
And it was, yeah.
It was cold.
No kidding. Oh. Yeah, the PAXes have always been pretty kind to us, except for the temperature of that one. But no, like we love to go all out with the crazy LED strips and sync them up to the game and try to come up with some crazy thing that you can see from a mile away and get people to be just zoned on into the booth. So yeah, we seem to find a bit of a crowd there.
What people don't really get is it's not the actual source of the light that's the issue. It's what it splashes up against. That's what you need.
When you
splash up against stuff, and then that's the thing that catches your eye, not the light itself. People don't get that, but I do know lighting engineers. They go, it's all about reflecting the light back onto other things. Then that splashes. It's much more subtle that way. And you definitely did that, whether that is intentional or not. I think it was.
Yeah, well, our first PAX East we didn't. It was just like a red. Well, I mean, we did, and that there were the lights, but we had like a red carpet, like everyone else. But then the next PAX East we paid for the fancy white carpet, which allows to have the lights reflect a lot more. And yeah, you're totally right. It's a huge part of it.
Yeah, it's definitely. Yeah, but and the game itself just pops out the screen anyway. But before we delve into that, I need to ask you some questions about you, Mr. Jordan.
All right.
Second question, then. Here we go. How did you make your start making video games?
Well, it's fairly straightforward. When I was really young, I definitely messed with a lot of like little programming things here and there, and tools, and built-in level editors and other games and stuff like that. So I knew that there was something there that I could do, and I found this school in the northwest of the U.S. called DigiPen in the Seattle area. And just said, all right, they make like their students go on to make these incredible games. Like the game Portal started as a student project, and then Portal 2 also started as a student project, a separate student project that they kind of merged into Portal. And it was like, okay, so there's like a career path there. They clearly are making interesting like little indie projects that look really cool. And I thought, all right, I guess that's the path. Like, I guess I need to be like a programmer or something. So they have a programming thing. So I only applied to that school, and fortunately I got in and just came out to Seattle. I was from the Midwest originally, kind of in the middle of the U.S. And yeah, so then that school kind of takes you through the paces. Like, you basically have I got a programming degree. I got to work with a lot of artists and a few designers. And every year they had you make like a project from scratch, like completely from scratch with C++. And that kind of taught you the hard way of, all right, if you want to write a graphics engine, you have to actually put every single pixel on the screen. And if you want to have a physics engine, you have to figure out how to stack boxes, or, you know, oh, wait, stacking boxes doesn't make sense in our game, so we don't have to implement that. Like, all of the different pieces of it. And I guess my niche ended up more being on the gameplay and design side, which I didn't really imagine when I started, because I started just as a programmer. And I ended up just being like, okay, seeing the whole thing to come together is the exciting part for me, not so much the little nooks and crannies of the code. So it was at least moving into distance. We graduated from DigiPen, a few of us that had worked on student projects together. And we were trying to figure out what we wanted to do just in general in the industry and what we could potentially do with projects. And we started up a new company. And we did a Kickstarter that basically said, hey, remember the student game we made, which was called Nitronic Rush? It was kind of a Tron plus Rush 2049 racing game. And fortunately for us, a lot of people on the internet seemed to like it. We kind of just got the back when things could go viral. We got one of those where we got a video on Reddit or something like that on the front page. And a lot of people played that game and seemed to enjoy it. So we were like, okay, what if we took like a bit of a more mature approach to the game in pretty much every way? Like, it was going to have more complex tools. It was going to have multiplayer. It was going to have a much deeper story. And we were going to do it kind of our own way from scratch again. So, yeah. So basically, ever since we graduated, we worked on that project. And here we are today with it finally released.
That's why I always congratulate developers when they come on the show before we record, everyone. But one of the first things to say to them is, first of all, thanks for coming on. Without them, be no show. But the other thing, reason is that, you know, I always say congratulations for finishing a game, which to the layman, I suppose outside the industry, sounds a bit patronizing, right? Well, you tell them they can't do what they're supposed to do. No, it's
yeah.
Not. It does, you know what I mean? It sounds a bit like, it's a bit insulting. It's not. Making a game is just really, really difficult. It's amazing anything gets finished, but it does eventually. Well, it gets to a state where you go, it's good enough, right?
Yeah.
It's just that whole concept, that whole philosophy of understanding what we mean by good enough. It sounds, again, weird, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know.
Yeah, it's definitely tricky, especially with this project where we had our Kickstarter. And our Kickstarter said the game's coming out in 2013. I think. And here we are in 2018, it finally came out. And I think there wasn't really ever a point in the project where it was like, oh, everything's going so horribly. How are we ever going to finish it? It was more that we kind of just set out at the beginning to make a completely insane game because we made the student project and we're like, okay, we know what we're doing. That didn't take too long. And then we just kind of didn't really think through how insane multiplayer would be, how insane it's actually mostly multiplayer, but the other part of it was just that we did early access and we had a beta with our Kickstarter people and with early access people just on Steam. And the amount of feedback they bring in was incredible, not just in, you know, volume, but like there were just some incredible ideas and we couldn't help but implement them. So we just kept expanding the size of the game. So at this, you know, at the end of the day, we definitely had a bigger game than we originally promised, but just trying to deliver what we originally promised was already an immense challenge. So that's, I think, the biggest thing that marks the completion of this game is, yes, all of those things that we told you were going to be in the game at the Kickstarter are actually in and good. They weren't just thrown in, you know, just to check the checkbox.
Mm. Yeah, it's feature creep is the bane of any creator of anything, really.
Absolutely.
And also designed by committee, you definitely know that never works. So
yeah,
bringing in ideas is lovely, but then you've got to understand that you've got to make a game here. Again, it's a common phrase I have with developers, and take a drink, everyone, regular listeners. But the creative process is very destructive. You know, there's a lot of ideas you create and go, this is wonderful. Not for this game, though. You know, it's going to be packaged up and say, well, that's lovely, that thing you've made. It's not really any good for this distance thing, is it? No, I know you upsold it, you pitched it, and we loved it, and then we saw it in action. It's like, just no. And it just, you need to be, that's one of the skills you need that as a designer, to know when to stop and when to say, this is what we're trying to achieve. We're just bolting things on here. I mean, sometimes people can get away with it. Slime Sam being a good example, where they just throw things at it, loads and loads of things, because they can, because that's comedy. That's the whole point of the game. It was just pitched as a ridiculous idea, and it is, and it's great for what it is. We've had him on the show. Lovely. But typically, it's like, that's great, but not for this game. I'm sure you've encountered this a lot, yeah?
Yeah, I think, absolutely. Our game is I'm excited to, have some time away from the release in a few months to look back and say, okay, I know right now that this game had a lot of scope problems and had, extended time frame issues and all this stuff. And despite the fact that I think the game came out well, it's like, what would I have told myself in 2012 to have corrected this problem? That's the main thing, I've been thinking about. And I'd say a big part of it really is just that, it being our first professional game, it wasn't our first really indie game, which is kind of crazy that when, I guess I should kind of clarify, when we were students, me in particular, I was really fortunate that almost every game I worked on, I guess I was willing to fail my other classes. I fortunately didn't, but I was willing to put that at risk so I could pretty much spend all my time working on these game projects. And I was just where my priorities really lied. And so a lot of those projects, I think almost all of them actually ended up earning some kind of an award or multiple awards. So sophomore year, we got into all four competitions that we submitted to, IGF, PAX, 10, Indiecade, and another one I can't remember, Indie Game Challenge, when GameStop, when they were doing a awards thing. And that gave us the really kind of interesting scenario where we're only halfway through school, only halfway kind of know what we're doing, but yet they're like, you need to go to this award ceremony and meet other indie devs and talk to big wigs who want to fund your next thing. And I'm like, not remotely ready for any of that. And that actually happened for three different projects, one of them being Neutronic Rush, where we kind of got to do the award circuit a little bit. And it was just interesting to kind of get the perspective of okay, we made our little indie game. Oh, people really liked it. Oh, people want to give us money to do something different, and trying to figure out what that all means. And then when we eventually graduated, we were like, if we could just do it through Kickstarter, if we could do it 100% on our own, we think we know what we're doing at this point. We can go and do that. But the reality is just that we still didn't really know what we were doing. We were still kind of in a little bit of an indie bubble, and actually, a student bubble, and exiting the academic world and going into the professional world and saying, okay, you're going to be asking for money now. You are going to be, a company with a brand, all of these things. It took a long time to kind of fully wrap our heads around what a lot of that meant. And that it's not really that it added to the scope of the game necessarily, but it did. It was something we did not account for in terms of working on the project and how much time that would all take.
Yeah, there are aspects of certainly setting up a company that normally warns you about. They give subtle hints to you, but nothing really concrete. You realize it's much more layered and complex than it ought be, but it's just the way it is. Tax, for example, registering a company, insuring it, insuring your employees, ensuring the employees against the company, all those things. It's just, it's layer upon layer of admin that you'd rather not be there, but it's required because you need protection and you need to protect you and the company and the staff, treat them with respect. And they may be your friends and founders and stuff, but they're still now staff. That sort of, it's no longer, university days eating pot noodles and stuff. No, it's ramen, I should say. This is real deal. Although you're still eating ramen, but
Yeah, of course,
but just not.
We're indies. We're
yeah, exactly. But
nothing's changed there.
No. Still eating those boiled noodles. Now, the next question is very difficult to answer. I found, and every time I try to pitch it, it always comes out of a mangled way. But I'll try it with you and see how we all settle down with this one.
All right.
What do you believe is Refract Studios' biggest influence as a creative team? What do you think is the thing that you orbit around more than anything?
I'm going to say early 2000s video games. Where, because I definitely thought about this a lot, because our creative team for sure does not really, we don't have like one game we all love or one studio necessarily. I don't even know if there is one studio or one game that we all just all happen to absolutely love. And there are definitely like certain games and even things way outside of games, music, movies, other art forms that two of us or three of us will really like. But that's something really interesting about our team, is there's kind of like, there's a few people on our team that really love Dark Souls, for example, and I like can't do it at all. I can't get into it at all. But I would say that pretty much all of us are about that age where we grew up with Halo and Half-Life and even some of the Final Fantasy games and all of these games that were happening on like PS2 and Xbox, the beginning of the 2000s, end of the 90s a little bit here too. And looking back, I definitely feel nostalgic for that time, because I feel like there was a thing back then where 3D was really coming into form in the AAA world. Indie wasn't really a thing yet, in what people consider it to be today. So I almost considered these AAA games to be indie, where they were really encouraged to be creative. They were really encouraged to create something very personal and to do something creative. And the formulas weren't still figured out, but we had all this money. What were we going to do with it? And you've got like Ico, Shadow of the Colossus. You've got the Silent Hill games, the Half-Life series, the Halo games, where I felt like every single time one of those came out, it was like they were doing something huge and bold and not really tiny. You know, it was like a big commitment to something really bold. And so when we talk about our game, a lot of times we joke and we say that it's a triple B game, because it's not a AAA game, but it's not really an indie game. Not because we don't want to be indie. I definitely consider us indie at the end of the day, but we kind of love that like game that's deceptively polished and stuff, where it looks like it maybe a big team made this. Oh wait, it's a pretty small experience. So there were a lot of those kinds of things I think that we all kind of share. But I wouldn't say there really is like even a genre or like a game or anything like that that we all collectively hold on to, which is what makes us what we are, that we're a collection of very different perspectives that all came together to try to create something that we think we can all contribute something unique to it.
So basically diversity.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm definitely always excited about that.
It's got a loaded phrase and it shouldn't be.
Sure.
But what I'm trying to say, a diverse set of opinions and ideas that have coalesced into this thing. And that is what is your biggest influence. And that's the best thing you could ask for, really. That's yeah, in my view.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and you're right, early 2000 games, they were, people don't really get this, but they were, you know, longer ago than you realize. That's the first thing. It wasn't just 10 years ago. No, it's more like almost 20.
You know, almost 20.
You're almost 20. Like, but I still remember playing Halo on Xbox. I know you do. But that was a long, long time ago, like 17 years ago. Oh,
yeah.
Boy. Because I used to remember sitting in the audience where they were releasing the PlayStation 2.
Yep. Yeah.
I was there when they released that, when they announced it to the world. And then we were talking about Toy Story graphics. That were the thing they were talking about.
Yeah.
It was great.
The jump in 3D for at least all of us programmers, that the the huge jumps in 3D every single time a new console would come out was like the most exciting thing ever. You know, I was still pretty young when the PlayStation came out, but by the time PlayStation 2 came out, it was just like, the future's going to be so incredible. And I don't really think I'm not saying that right now we're completely void of creativity or people making big jumps like that. But it just, there was something really magical about that time where it just really was, it just felt like anything was possible because it really was like people are spending a lot of money on making these projects, but comparatively to what they're spending today, it was actually nothing. So I feel like there was less of an expectation for every single thing to be a blockbuster on the scale that it is today. And so
we led down to a path that, you know, EA have done some very, very silly things. As of the other major publishers, it's best not go there, but you and I know what we're talking about. And because of the expenditure required to make these games, and the sheer volume of people sort of talking about how their games are now requiring 100 gigabyte installation. Like, what?
Yeah. I mean, this is definitely a massive topic. I'm definitely one of those people who doesn't view a 60-hour game as a positive feature. Yeah. I would love if I could get a AAA game that was like 5 hours or less and was just as polished, if not even more polished. Like, it's just perfect, like a perfect 5 hours. And I totally believe people could do it, but people don't believe there's a market for it. And indies, to me, are definitely proof that there is a market for it. Yeah. So we just need to figure out how to kind of bridge that gap. And that's like the big question mark.
Mm. Well, okay. Now, you did say this earlier that you didn't have a big favorite developer, but I'm going to ask you that question anyway. Is there any particular developer that you'd nod at and go, please carry on what you're doing? That'll be great. Thanks.
It's tough. Cause a lot of things have changed in the past few years. When I grew up, it was definitely Valve, and Valve these days is a very, very different company who I respect a lot of the people there. But, the early like Half-Life 2, team, that kind of stuff, that was like colossal inspiration for me to move out to Seattle to kind of go that route. Strangely enough, my inspirations now are completely different than they were when, you know, even like when we started this company, now kind of seeing it from the other side. But I would say Playdead, the folks who made Limbo and Inside, Arnt Jensen, that team is a team that I deeply admire because obviously they put a lot of like heart and try to put a lot of personality into their projects, and they definitely know what they're doing from an artistic perspective, but almost more than anything, it's just the boldness of the way that they release their games, with it being extremely, you know, like I said, like it's just a few hour game that's deeply focused, and when they market it, they really just keep it very simple, and they just trust that people will actually be there, and that confidence really blows me away. It's like just saying, you know, because going through distance, I think I look at a lot of the feedback and I say, okay, this is what I want to make. This is what the people want me to make. And a lot of times there is a big difference between that, between the two of them. And there's obviously a lot of crossover too. But it's really hard to shut off the, I don't care what anyone else thinks. I just want to make my thing. And, you know, some people have that. I'd say Kojima seems to be one of those people right now where – PT is probably my favorite game of the past 10 years.
Which wasn't a game. Well,
right. Okay. Yeah. Exactly. So there's a whole nother discussion, but, it's my favorite interactive experience. And I think that says that, I mean, that also kind of shows you, another example of kind of what inspires me these days, where I love that like really high quality, simple, detailed experience that didn't have, and it tried to do a lot of different things in terms of storytelling and interactivity. And for me, it was so much more than just a horror game. I mean, I think a lot of people just saw it as, oh, they're like, it's like the scariest thing ever. But once you kind of get past that, there's so much depth in there. And that definitely was a pretty clear inspiration for stuff I'm working on now. So I have no idea what's going on with Death Stranding. I only saw the first trailer, and then I just haven't. I'm like, okay, I'm sold. I don't need to watch anymore. So I tend to do that with marketing. I basically just, if I know I want to pay money for it already, I'm not going to consume anymore. So I'm a little out of the loop with that one. But I'm just excited because a lot of the people that worked on PT, as far as I can tell, are working on that. So I just want to see them work on something that creatively interests them.
I mean, there are a lot of developers. Like, I actually mentioned sort of Jeff Minter early on. He's one of those who's like, I'll just make this game. There are times when I'm playing on VR Polybius, and it's just, I'm yelling at Jeff. He's not there, of course. I'm going, I can't see what's going on, Jeff. What is this? Why is there a telephone there, Jeff? Jeff, you know, because it is. But it's just his vision, and I've spoken to him about it many times, and he says, "It's about the games, dummy. It's the game. That's what matters." Yeah. And he can't really vocalize it well or describe it enough. But what he's saying is, it's about the experience, it's about the game, about the interaction, about, it's not just risk reward and all those breakdown of mechanics. It's not about that. It's really about the experience and getting reward and feeling of achievement, because that's why you're playing it in the first place, right? You know.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that I'm most excited to explore is, you know, the patterns are definitely becoming more apparent as time goes on of what a game, quote unquote, is, and how, you know, a lot of times it's supposed to make you feel empowered and all these things. And, you know, the PT was a good example to me of something that did the exact opposite, and that's why I loved it, or one of the many reasons I loved it. But I'd say that at the same time, it was what they were exploring an emotional spectrum that it was different, but it was what they were going after. And that's the cool part, is kind of seeing what they wanted you to get out of it, what kind of emotions they wanted to pull from the player.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, last question of the first half. See, you made it. Well done.
Yay!
Yay! Now, I have to ask this because, you know, video game podcast, got to ask this question. What are you playing right now?
Not much.
Okay, that's cool.
I did play Spider-Man.
Right.
I blasted through the campaign.
Okay.
And that is one of those experiences for sure that I'm like, oh man, I wish they did a lot of things differently, but they did a lot of things very, very well. So, you know, definitely, don't regret playing through it. And man, what else have I played recently? Not a lot. Okay. Finishing the game recently has been taking up all my time. And
I understand. I mean, one of the qualifiers I always have is like, what are you playing right now, excluding distance?
I'll tell you what I want to play this month. It's October month, and over the past few years, I've increasingly become obsessed with horror, as you probably could tell by my going on about PT. Mm. And I'm excited to replay Silent Hill 2, because that was another like pretty impactful game for me in the past few years. But there's definitely like a queue of horror games that I'm excited to kind of revisit, to see if, now having worked on some kind of weird story stuff over the past few years, to see if my perspective has changed. So I've heard Deadly Premonition is good. I didn't actually know anything about that game until like a month ago. Right. So I'm excited to try that one out.
Yeah, I must admit, jump scares for me, and they're not always jump scares. I get that. I understand. But horror games, I've got so far with them, but for some reason, I never really progressed beyond 2 or 3 hours into them. It's not because I get scared. It's like I might just get distracted by something shiny. I mean, I never finished the Silent Hill games, but when I think of Silent Hill, I just get radio static in my head.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's just like, it is quite terrifying. And you know, the whole fog, they made the game like, well, we can't actually draw very far, but hey, let's make it a thing.
and
it's lovely for them to do that. And like, we can't actually draw this thing in distance because obvious reasons, but let's just make it, you know, a story point. So it's okay, the fog's real, everyone.
Yeah.
But it's terrifying when you first encounter the beasties out there, because you think, this is the town and foggy. What's the big, oh, God.
Oh yeah, it's such a funny idea that almost all games have like some horror section in it, but the idea of like, you know, taking that and making it a whole game out of it, if you looked at it from that perspective, is like, but no, they're like, they're just supposed to be like a break. I'm not supposed to be in there for forever.
No. And
get me out of here.
But there are lots of PS1 and PS2 games that really delved into that realm. And then, of course, Amnesia and stuff like that. That one of the classic things is you are in a very dangerous place, unarmed, and you have no way of defending yourself, nor will you ever have any means to defend yourself other than run or hide.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's a big sort of appeal for that. And I don't know, for me, I'm one of these odd people that I do get anxious and scared. And I remember there's a bit in Gone Home where they sort of ratchet up the tension when there's no tension to be had. That's another form of psychological warfare against the player. Like, let's just pretend that something weird is going on when it isn't.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Do you know the bit I'm talking about? Maybe. I don't know. But,
absolutely.
Yeah. It's like, oh,
that's that was actually a disappointment to me. I was just like, and now the horror's going to kick in. Oh, it never did.
No, it didn't. No. Calm down.
That's fine.
Still vanilla. Still vanilla.
Yeah.
And like, you know, Firewatch has a little bit of that sometimes. But you realize that, no, it's just regular. But the same can't be said for Everybody's Gone to the Rapture, because that's a very, very strange game. And there's the reason I'm sort of citing all these titles, because they allude to what you just said. They sort of go to emotional places that are uncomfortable, which is an anathema to video games. Why would you want to make the player uncomfortable? That's just, never do that. You know, you don't want to make a game frustrating and uncomfortable. Why not? You know, it's just when you read a novel, and a very good one, and it has drama and it has pathos and what have you, and there's bad things are happening. You're not experiencing, you're vicariously looking in from the outside in, imagining what these things are happening, but it's not to you. So what's the problem? You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, actually, you're reminding me. I did play through both Everyone's Gone to the Rapture and Firewatch earlier this, like, you know, 6 months ago or something, just looking for inspiration. And that, for me, I feel like it's so hard. I'm just watching other developers struggle with this. I don't think it's easy at all. But I see the whole, we want, you know, that game company is like the epitome of this, actually, where they want to, their big mission is to explore the emotional spectrum. Mm-hmm. And their kind of stuff is very much on the positive end of the spectrum. Like, we want to explore the concept of giving in their new game, Sky. So it's like, okay, that's something usually gamers, I think, in a lot of games, is like, I'm the hero, I want everything, give to me. And this game says, no, you need to give to other people. And they actually create, you know, mechanics that kind of get you to do that. Mm. And that I think is really great. But the ironically, that I love their perspective on expanding the emotional spectrum, but I want to go the other route. Because you're right, where it's like, you, when you say, I don't want to make the player feel terrible for 10 hours, it's not, you know, and for some people, yes, they're just going to feel terrible for 10 hours. So it's not the experience for them. But I do think it allows, just like a good horror movie or novel, like you're saying, it's all about exploring other parts of your mind that you're not, you know, encountering in everyday life, much like feeling like a superhero. I don't feel like that in everyday life either. But I can, you know, okay, so now I'm in like a scary situation that maybe is related to myself personally or my character personally, and kind of, you know, as an excuse to explore that. So, yeah.
Yeah. Totally. Well, what's the risk to you personally? Well, nothing apart from an emotional reaction. You know, you can stop playing the game. You can walk away if you like at any time. You can close the book, or you can stop the film, whenever you like. You know, nothing's actually physically going to harm you. It's just an emotional reaction to what you're seeing. And one of the things I love about Everyone's Got to the Rapture, and when I know you've played it now, so I can actually ask the question, have you ever considered who you are in that game?
I did. I mean, I definitely right off the bat was thinking that.
Never explains it. Never tells you.
Yeah. And I actually thought that was kind of a cool,
lovely
idea, that you get so wrapped up in the other characters that it seems almost unimportant until it becomes important. You know, it's like,
it's basically, you know, so the title of the game is Everybody's Gone to the Rapture. So who are you?
Yeah, exactly.
What are you doing there? If everybody's gone, so I just love that answer. And then no one's ever actually given me a satisfactory answer. And I don't think the game does either. And I don't want one. You know what I mean? I don't. Something. I mean, I have an answer. You might balk it and go, "Oh, don't be a moron, Chris." But it's that's my own personal takeaway, and I've never actually told anyone what I believe you are, or what you are.
Sure.
If there is indeed a what or who, both, of course, it's both. But I have a theory, and I just left it in my head rather than share it because I just like it to be that way. And I'm sure you've got an idea. Yeah. It might be more mundane or even fantastical versus mine. But that's the wonderful thing about that game, that experience. It is a beautiful rendition of a British village in 1983.
Yeah.
And just leave it like that. So, yeah. Okay. Well, that's the end of the first half.
Awesome.
Well done. We're now going to go into the second half to delve deep into distance. So, first question isn't really a question. We have to do this in order to set up the rest of the questions. It's a request. do your best, and I'm going to really take a deep breath as you try and do this. Please tell us, what is distance?
All right. So distance is what we're calling an atmospheric racing platformer. So core idea is that you're a car in this futuristic, deadly world. Where everything's trying to kill you. And as you're trying to survive these crazy twisted tracks where you're kind of going from point A to B, more in a platformer sense, your car has all these abilities to jump, fly, and rotate. So you can kind of do parkour maneuvers. In certain areas, your wings get corrupted, and you have to use the rotation jets to maneuver and jump on buildings and walls. And the core story mode of the game kind of has you dropped into this very mysterious city that exists on the edge of Earth. It's on this, just in space, and it uses teleportation to kind of jump around between all these different satellite sectors. And you're essentially investigating a threat, and you're pursuing it. And then beyond the story campaign, the primary story campaign, we have arcade modes where it's pretty much just about getting to the end, going point A to B as fast as you can, and getting the best times. And then in multiplayer, it's, you know, continued extension of that where you're racing against other people to get the best times. We have like a reverse tag mode where it's like tag, but you want to be it. So that kind of gets you to jump on buildings and, jump around these crazy arenas. You're just trying to grab onto the being it for as long as you can. We've got random track generation. So we've got tracks that you just type in like a seed. Like you say, I want like crazy twisted red track, and it will attempt to create a crazy twisted red track. We've got a few hundred like modifiers that try to figure out what you were wanting it to be. And yeah, I think that's the core of it. The game really is divided into two sections where it's like story stuff and arcade stuff, and arcade's just random crazy. You never know what level is going to come up next. But yeah, it's definitely very much like it's a platformer that happens to feature a car.
That's, yeah, definitely.
Definitely the core of it.
If you see a screenshot, you go, oh, it looks like, you know, like an arcade racer. No, it looks like it.
Yeah. But it's
still absolutely doesn't do it justice. It really doesn't, in my view.
it's actually really hard to not show it in motion. I think that's why we do decently well at conventions, but it can be hard, and even a GIF or something, to kind of see what it's really all about, because there's no HUD on the screen. There's no traditional HUD. All of the important information you need is on the car itself. So we tried, and that's kind of the atmospheric part of the atmospheric racing platform, where we really wanted to create something that we hadn't really seen in many cases, which is a racing game that really has its own unique world, that has its own rules, and kind of there's like a reason why this kind of gameplay exists within this world. But this car is essentially the central character, and the car kind of has a little bit of a mysterious backstory to themselves as well. But the information all being on the car is all kind of like the status of the car, and kind of like, so if, as you're driving through, you're boosting, and it's kind of like a run button, but eventually you will run out of boost and you'll overheat and explode. So you need to be hitting checkpoints or cooldown rings as you go along to keep from overheating. And we essentially replaced the brake lights on the car with the with an overheat meter. Yeah. So stuff like that is all just directly integrated.
Who needs brakes? At least one game like this.
No, you're going fast.
Yeah.
You're going fast or dying, pretty much.
I want to ask about, so it's the first proper question now, so brace yourself. I told you it ramps up. The first question is, I want to ask about a camera view behind the car, because it is behind the car, everyone. It's sort of third person car driving, which I know people who play Forza go, no, it's not Forza, let it go. So it's camera view behind the cars. I think, and you might say it's not true, but it seems to be slightly distorted.
And oh, yeah.
It's creating like a tunnel view of what your real perception or would be. Is this, you know, deliberate, and why?
So from a purely design perspective, the whole goal is to create a sense of speed, like create the right sense of speed. You don't want to feel like it's so fast you can't control it, but not so slow that it's not exciting. So when we initially were working on the game, and this was definitely based on our student game, we essentially extend the field of view. So, you know, it starts at like 60 and ends up at 120. And that makes it so basically at the edges of your screen, everything's just blasting past like really fast and kind of distorted. The reality is this wasn't really the best way to do this, just in hindsight, where it does like lend itself to kind of a unique look, but it does definitely distort the world around you a little bit, which can make it a little bit hard to kind of take in the scenery. But it's one of those things where we kind of just got away with it enough. Like it's not like 180 field of view. It's like, and also when we even did like eye tracking at some point, just for fun, to see how people were playing the game. And we found out that people were basically looking at this tiny little circle in the center of the screen, pretty much nowhere else, you know, majority of the time. So we knew that that part was the most clear part. And then people could still avoid the obstacles and whatnot. But
yeah, it's something I've highlighted to developers when I'm playing demos of their games at PAX or whatever event, like REST or something. I say to them, you do realize that I can only see this sort of egg shape in the middle of the screen, right?
Yeah, exactly.
What do you mean? Like, well, where's my health? It's down there. I can't see it. I've no idea how healthy. That's why I just died, because I've no idea I had no health, because it's down there. I can't see it. Could you put it on my character or something, or put it on somewhere in there? And also, I cite Destiny as a good example, because the health bar for Destiny is this big crescent just at the top of your view, and it's actually within that bubble. And you just look up, just barely look up, and go, oh, okay, I've got that much health. It's genius. Yeah. Well, this is Bungie. What are you going to do? But, you know, it's just like, yeah, that makes sense. And this leads me on to my second question. You mentioned, spoke at length about the UI being centered on the car itself, which is a great idea, because that's where some of your attention is. Although when I'm driving, when I'm playing distance, I'm actually looking in the distance. Hey, there we go. I'm sure you heard that.
There it is.
There it is. That's how driving games or games like this work. You have to see where you're going, not where you've been, because that's too late then. Or where you
Absolutely.
Are. Don't look at where you are, because that's too late. You need to go where you're going. So, my concern is, how do you think you manage to convey as much information as you need in such a small space?
Well, if you break it down, the only thing you really need to know on the car is your overheat status. And that being on the brake lights is definitely a very technical answer to like where your overheat status is. But when you're overheating, the whole car's screen changes color to start flashing to this red color. Mm-hmm. And the entire outside of the screen, like 75% of the screen, the circle around your car, all starts turning into red, and the camera starts shaking and the controller starts shaking. So one way or another, and I thought it was funny when we first started implementing this, we're like, this is way too much. It's like, nope, it's still basically not enough. You know, I feel like it's fine actually as is. We've done enough testing to feel safe with that one. But yeah, it's like the stuff being on the car is kind of a bonus, really. The design of it at the end of the day that works is the fact that it's all this other stuff that you don't notice directly as like that's a thing I'm directly looking at, but you feel that extreme sense of danger as the whole screen's shaking, everything's turning red, it's your car's, you know, turning red and flashing. Something I gotta stop doing something. So that's usually how and the audio all coming together to say yes, I'm gonna overheat. So the other elements on the car, I think you've got like a speedometer, you've got a compass. A lot of those things started off as, yeah, those are going to be really helpful. And as time goes on, we just realize, like, kind of like you're saying, it's really hard to focus on, you know, as close as that is to the center of the screen, it's still not in the center of the screen. So we modified the camera at one point to help you with your sense of direction. So it used to be a lot more like just snap to the back of the car. And if you're jumping onto a wall and driving on the wall, the camera basically just rotates with it, and now it just looks like you're on a wall, but you're just down, you know, on the ground. And we made it so that the camera constantly keeps gravity in mind, so it like kind of, you know, tries to convert between the actual ground and where you're at. And a lot of that helped a lot to like basically solve the problem with, you know, needing a compass in the first place. So that's kind of what I think is funny is we ended up actually releasing a few cars that don't have any car screen on them. We've got like a Jaguar is like this car that's like a Jacko, I guess it's Jack-o'-lantern is what it's supposed to be referencing. It's just a skeleton car. It's the same car, but it's just the skeleton version we released for Halloween. And no screen on it, and you just don't really need it. It's one of those like it maybe be a little helpful in like multiplayer to know if you're first place or whatnot, but the other specific details of the car that show like the grip of your tires or the speed of your car or even your overheat are like not as important or not they're not that important at the end of the day. They're kind of just fun.
Yeah. So I just found it fascinating. It was one of the things that sort of drew me to the game is the fact you have this sort of hovering UI sitting on the back of the car. And like you say, there's a compass, and then there's the overheat, which is the key. And there's also a clock, which you didn't mention.
Oh, yeah, sure.
There's the big clock thing that tells you how long you've been banging away at this thing. But it's counting down. It's wonderful how the voiceover sort of interacts with how much time you have. Quite interesting how you did that. I don't want to spoil it too much. I'll just leave it at that.
But yeah, sure.
It does talk about, it says interact with the player's performance or lack of.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just to wind them up a bit like, you suck. Come on. How can that be? Just rotate the car. I know, but it's like, come on. It's got to jump just at the right moment. So, which leads me on to my last question. There is a need to push the boundaries of the track, and where the player can go is actively encouraged by the game, by distance. It encourages the player to explore and do things that wouldn't normally do with a car. How do you believe distance communicates this to the player?
Oh, man. I mean, that has taken all of the 6 years, and I still feel like we could do better. So in general, there's a theme of creativity, I think, at Refract. That's like another thing that we all share in that either, you know, just in the fact that we've spent so much time on our level editor. That is like a colossal part of the game that I probably should have mentioned in the description, where you can create your own levels just the same as we do. And you can, there's already like 2,600 of them on Workshop.
There is. I was going to mention that at the end, but yeah, carry on. Yeah.
And, anyways, I say all that because I look back on that and say, you know what? That really does make sense that we spent so much time on that because we love just the concept of creativity and enabling that. And in the car's controls, I think that was another kind of or in the car's mechanics, that was like another component of that, which was just simply that your car in a normal racing game is constrained to the track. And I know at least myself and the guy who made all of the car physics and, you know, it's kind of like our lead gameplay guy. We were the kind of people that fire up NASCAR 2000 and instantly go backwards and try to build up 200 miles an hour so you can hit some random car going also 200 miles an hour and just see what happens with the physics. And like going and driving the perfect track and, you know, getting the perfect time wasn't that exciting to us. It was about messing with it. And Gran Turismo, as much as I absolutely love the original like four Gran Turismos, I haven't played the other ones as much, but you try to like go off the track even like a little bit and the physics are like, whoa, what are you doing? Like, that's not allowed. And it like just snaps you back down in like the most, you know, like it looks like it acknowledges the fact that it's broken. And just like at this point, they don't care what it looks like. They just want to get it back to normal. And our game was kind of the opposite where it's just like, yes, the physics allow a lot of weirdness. But we're just going to embrace it. So we try to think of clever ways where, like, if your car gets flipped over, the car automatically will try to flip itself back. You can shut that off in the menus if you don't like that. But we have, like, an auto-writing, you know, thing. And in the actual track design and the actual, like, adventure campaign, we attempted to create tracks that the only way to get through it is to properly jump off, get yourself onto that road, and be, you know, make it just barely hard enough where you can't accidentally just be like, oh, I just kind of ended up on this road. It's like, no, I had to actively jump and rotate myself and then get onto the side road so that I can say, oh, I could do that anywhere if I really wanted to. So there are certain sections in the track that attempt to kind of say, okay, hey, here's a wall or here's some like weird section where you're being flipped upside down. The only way to get through it is to like correct yourself and put yourself in the right place. So I'd say, you know, majority of it really was figuring out kind of the realm of possibilities for the car's movement and then just exploring level design for years. And I wouldn't say that I felt like we ever found something that was 100% perfect. It still feels like there's possibilities out there, but you know, like you said earlier, we do the best you can in the time frame you have. And then you kind of watch to see what the community does with that. And people have made tracks that are so much crazier than we ever comprehended. There was a certain point where we actually added a new ability halfway through the early access beta where you could enable all of the jets at the same time, and we called it grip. And it basically just smashed your car down in any direction that, you know, the car is facing. Where the wheels are, you know, facing. And we realized that was an interesting one where you could flip your car upside down, hold it, and then you can basically hover because the jets are like holding you up. And things like that, we kind of saw the potential in the gameplay, but didn't really know exactly, you know, what you could do within the level. We created like a, you know, kind of a test level that we shipped in the beta. And then there was this level called Inferno that came out that it was the first time I had seen – it was a community-created track. It was the first time I had seen someone make a level that truly required that feature, that you had walls that were completely perpendicular to the ground and there was a gap between them. So you jump and then you have to use all the jets to slam yourself back down against the next wall basically. And I'm doing hand gestures over here, but it's not very helpful. but – It's definitely one of those like back and forth things with the community where we were like, oh, okay, that kind of like brutal difficulty actually really pushes the mechanics that we had implemented. So yeah, I don't know if I answered your question, but I'd just say it was a lot of back and forth and
we did our best. You did a really good job. I think you've done a great job. And it's the fact that up is down, down is up and left is right, right is left, and understanding that 1 minute, you know, gravity, you think gravity's there, actually, you know, it's over here now. It's quite, it takes a little getting used to, which is why I asked the question. Actually, I think I skipped a question. I know I did. Look, I've got number three. I didn't do number three. And I really want to talk about number three because it's, this is generally everyone, the last question. We are recording late, by the way, so that's my excuse. I've noticed there are saw blades on the screen sometimes, on the levels in the campaign. And granted, in the user created things, there's even more crazy things, but let's stick with the, what's in the standard game. And, I'm not just a car could take some damage from these blades and still go on.
I mean,
it can take slices out of the car and still go. Why?
Yes. Because it's awesome.
Rule of cool, then, basically. Is that
a rule of cool always wins, yeah. So we did our student game, Nitronic Rush. That game, there's actually the campaign Lost to Echoes that you unlock after finishing the adventure campaign. That is an homage to that student game. And you can kind of see in that, because it's got very similar art style, we have all these laser gates. And back in the day, because the guy, Jason, on our team, who did all the car physics and did a lot of the gameplay stuff, they created those laser gates way back when. They're really heavy on physics. And they were like, okay, you know, if I got the time, what I would want to do is I would want to figure out how the laser actually can, like, slice the car, because that would just be a cool tech demo-y thing. And we ran out of time with the student game, of course. But when we started this new project, we got the bare bones car in there. The car was barely playable. Got to get the laser slicing in, he says. And it's like, okay. So the whole idea just being that, because it started with lasers, where you've just got these lasers, they're just like a beam shooting into the ground. Mm. And if you drive through them, it dynamically cuts you. And the gameplay is modified, quote unquote, as you'd expect, it's like you basically lose your steering. You can still boost and you can kind of turn. I think you can turn about, you know, half or roughly half of what you could before. But I think he implemented it and he was like, yep, this is pretty cool. And just kept tweaking the controls so that it felt, you know, whatever a person would think is correct for that. And it ended up being one of the coolest features in the game, just that people can toss down a bunch of lasers and saws and all kinds of things that can rip you apart. And it's like the fun really is just that you get through it, and if you hit the next checkpoint, it'll restore you. So there's this sense of hope that I got hit by the laser, but that's kind of like a half obstacle. It's now really challenging, but I think I can just barely make it. Oh, yes, I got it. Okay, my car's restored. Good to go.
Yeah. So having a third of the car just sliced off, and it's like, wait, I'm still going? Yeah. What do you want?
That really just stemmed from a dissatisfaction with, you know, like other games that would have lasers and stuff and just be like, but wouldn't it be cool if, and it's like, all right, we'll do it ourselves.
Yeah, because every time you see it in any other games, it's like, oh, explodo. Oh, you ran into that. They explode. Whereas in distance, it's, well, that's kind of a dumb thing. But dumb thing to do, because, you know, you're meant to be, we want finesse. We don't want to go through like a bulldozer, but all right, here's your punishment. Like, wait, this is punishment? Yeah, well, because it's just got a whole red glowy bit that's sliced off and looks like a Tron car or something. It's just, if they had them, they didn't have bikes, didn't they? But you know what I mean? It's cool. I just wanted to mention it because it's a lovely feature. You could have taken out. I mean, for me, that was the kind of thing you'd, if it was in a major developer, they go, that's fun. Yeah, take it out. Well, people get confused. You know what I mean? Major studio would go, that's funny. Yeah, take it out.
I don't know. I think it's one of those that's really interesting in other games where you've got like the Metal Gear game that was all about slicing. But that being it, where it was the whole point was the slicing.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I love so much about our game is that you can play through the whole game and never have it happen.
Yeah.
And definitely there's that point where I might have even been the one to bring it up saying, we can't have this cool feature and have it even be a chance that you don't see it. And, you know, then eventually coming around to the idea that what's so magical about it is the fact that it feels like it was spontaneous. It doesn't feel like it was a planned thing. And when it happens, you know, you can tell your friend, hey, I got sliced. And they're like, what? How did that happen? That didn't happen to me. You know, and you can kind of have that like unique moment, even if it's not that unique. It's just something that is something you might miss. So that's the risk.
I mean, it goes back to the old, you know, playground stuff where you're sort of telling tall stories about to your friends about weird and wonderful things that happen in video games. And then one of those tall stories happens to be true.
Anyway, absolutely.
You know, like, oh, yeah, I found this invisible platform in Mario. No, you didn't. Yep. You liar. And then lots of punching and threatening, and then eventually drag them around to your home and prove it to them after the 50th turn. Like, see?
Yeah. And then it doesn't, yeah, exactly. It doesn't work the first few times. No, seriously.
Yeah. And they're now actually sort of like holding you, like doing the, you know, getting your neck hold and trying to choke you. Like, just let me do this. Just let me do this.
Classic urban legends leading to all kinds of fun times.
Some of them were true. Vast majority of them weren't, but some of them,
absolutely,
it's the ones that were true, and that's, I think, whether you like it or not, it might have been subconsciously you're drawing that from your childhood, going, yeah, let me just do some weird stuff that people go, that doesn't work, that will wait. Because I actually did discover it when I was playing on the, well, I didn't, that's not true, not gonna do that. A friend of mine pointed it out to me, going, go into the laser, well, just graze the, he told me, graze the laser.
Oh, yeah,
just graze it, well, just do it. But it's going to just, trust me, okay? And it's like a slither got taken out. It's one of the earlier levels where you were doing a great job of demonstrating to the player that this wasn't a driving game. And it was going relatively slow pace. So I could actually aim the laser to a point I could slice a bit off. And like, ha! I feel like a lump of ham now. Like, yep, it's awesome.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, along those lines, like the early 2000s, late 90s video games, like one of the things that we really were excited about is we have this cheat system that we added right at the end of the development, which was one of those like, it's amazing. All these people who added Easter eggs in, you know, older AAA games, I feel like they don't really have them anymore. But people that used to, you know, spend the late night weekends or whatever, they bust out some dumb random thing and throw it in as an Easter egg or as like a cheat you can unlock.
Yeah.
And we decided, okay, like we're going to plan for this to actually be a feature, but our way of getting around it was just saying we wanted to make achievements valuable because achievements are just kind of worthless usually. Like they're just an idea. And it's like, okay, you complete this achievement, you actually get something. So that's how you unlock cars, and it's also how you unlock these cheats. So like one of the cheats is something called motorcycle mode, which just every time that your car spawns, it just chops it in half instantly. And you have to drive the whole rest of the track as half a car. Because people always ask us for forever for a motorcycle. We're like, all right, it's in.
There you go. There's your motorcycle.
Enjoy.
That's not the same. Shut up. Yeah, it is.
Close enough.
It's close enough. But that's... Don't stop. This is what you asked for. No. Fine.
Yeah.
So, Distance is out now for Windows, it PC, is. Mac, and Linux. Right?
Dude.
Yeah, and I actually played on my Mac because I actually got that's my Mac is a laptop because I travel a lot and that thing can, you know, take a punishment.
Nice.
So that's why I have that. But my gaming machine is a Windows PC because that's what you do, right? When you're doing gaming on a PC or a computer, you generally have a Windows PC because you can play anything.
Yeah, seems to be the thing.
That's the way it works. So. Yeah, thanks Windows 10 for randomly updating and, you know, trying to destroy files, apparently. Topical joke.
Of course.
Hey. And of course, so Skype updating every 20 minutes. It's probably just updated now.
Indeed.
And then they move the chat again. There's something about the chat icon. They love moving. Jordan, it's been fantastic having you on the show. Thank you very, very much for sharing your time with us and chatting about the excellent Distance.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
I'm sure I hope you had a good time. I know I did. And,
yeah, I definitely did.
We wish you the very best of luck in future endeavors, whatever they may be, and you're more than welcome to come back and chat to us about them in a couple of years, at least.
Sounds great.
Maybe three.
meantime, maybe six or seven.
Six or seven. But in the meantime, we'll thank you very, very much, Tom.
Yeah, thank you.